there is every possibility that this was an Anglo-Saxon burial site. She'd said, going on to explain that it was so named because the Anglo-Saxons believed that dragons watched over their treasure. Of course, the Celts would have disagreed. They would have called this a fairy mound and said that beneath it lay the entrance to fairyland. Ada had thought then of the amulet in the library and wondered whether this was where Miss Radcliffe had found her protection charm. "Not far from here," Miss Radcliffe had replied. "Not far from here at all." To Ada, being a member of the Natural History Society was like being a detective, looking for clues and solving mysteries. Every relic they unearthed came with a story, a secret life led long before the object reached their hands. It became a game of sorts to come up with the most exciting, yet plausible, for they were scientists and not creative writers, history for each find. Miss Radcliffe always let them keep their treasures. She was adamant about it. "The earth gives up its secrets in good time," she liked to say, "and always to the person it intends." "What about the river?" Ada had asked one Saturday morning, when their adventures had taken them close to the water's edge. She had been thinking about a story Shashi had told her, about a flood that came to her village and washed away her precious childhood possessions. She realised too late her terrible faux pas, for Ada had heard whispers by then that Miss Radcliffe's brother had died by drowning. "Rivers are different," the headmistress said at last, her voice steady, but her face paler than usual beneath her freckles. "Rivers are always on the move. They take their secrets and mysteries with them to the sea." Miss Radcliffe herself was something of a mystery. For a woman who put her name to a school proposing to turn young girls into civilized ladies, she was not particularly ladylike. Though she had all of the manners that Mama liked to talk about, she didn't chew with her mouth open or burp at the table. But in other ways, she reminded Ada far more of Papa. Her purposeful stride when they were out in the open air, her willingness to talk about subjects like politics and religion, her insistence that it was incumbent on one to strive always for the attainment of knowledge, to demand better information to do so. She spent most of her time outside and had no care for fashion, always dressing in precisely the same way. Dark leather button-up boots and a green walking suit, the long skirt of which was always caked with mud about the hem. She had a large woven basket that reminded Ada of Shashi's, and she carried it wherever she went. But where Shashi filled her basket with fruit and vegetables, Miss Radcliffe's was used for carrying sticks and stones and birds' eggs and feathers and all manner of other natural objects that had piqued her interest. Ada was not the only person to have noticed Miss Radcliffe's eccentricities. The school was hers, and yet, aside from delivering occasional fierce and imploring speeches about the duty of you girls to learn as much as possible, and offering the general admonishment that time is your most precious commodity, girls, and there's none so foolish as those that waste their minutes. She left matters of administration and discipline to the deputy headmistress, Miss Thornfield. Amongst the other girls, it was rumoured that she was a witch. To start with, there were all those plant samples and oddities, not to mention the room in which she kept them. It was a small chamber adjoining her bedroom that students were forbidden from entering on pain of death.
"That's where she does her spells," Angelica Barry insisted. "I've heard her from the other side, chanting and intoning."
And Meredith Sykes swore that she had glimpsed inside the door one day and, amongst the stones and fossils, seen a human skull upon the bureau top. One thing was certain, Miss Radcliffe loved her house. The only time she ever raised her voice was in castigation of a girl caught sliding on the banisters or kicking along the skirting boards. On one of their walks across Wiltshire, talk had turned to loneliness and special places, and Miss Radcliffe had explained to Ada that Birchwood Manor had once belonged to her brother, that he had died many years before, and that, although she still missed him more than anything else she'd ever lost, she felt close to him when she was inside his house.
"He was an artist,"
Ada's fellow rambler Meg had said once, apropos of nothing, looking up from the clover necklace she was threading.
"Miss Radcliffe's brother, a famous artist, but his fiancée was killed with a rifle and afterwards he went mad with grief. Now her reverie interrupted by the proximity of her tormentors, Ada shifted carefully in her hiding place within the wall, mindful not to make even the tiniest of noises. She did not know much about lovers or fiancés, but she knew how much it hurt to be separated from a loved one, and she felt immensely sorry for Miss Radcliffe. Ada had decided that it was the loss of her brother that explained the expression of deep unhappiness that came upon her headmistress's face sometimes when she thought no one was watching. As if she had somehow read Ada's thoughts, there came now a familiar voice on the other side of the wall panel. "Girls, what are you doing in the hallway? You know how Miss Thornfield feels about skulking."
"Yes, Miss Radcliffe," they chorused.
"I cannot think what could be keeping you so interested in here."
"Nothing, Miss Radcliffe."
"I hope you are not dragging those hockey sticks along my wall."
"No, Miss Radcliffe."
"Well then, off you go, and I will consider not mentioning this infraction to Miss Thornfield for her detention list." Ada heard their footsteps scuttle away and allowed herself a small sigh of satisfied relief. "Out you climb then, child," said Miss Radcliffe, rapping gently on the wall. "You must have a class you're missing too."
Ada slipped her fingers into the hidden latch and unhooked the panel, cracking the door open. Miss Radcliffe had already disappeared, nowhere to be seen, and Ada climbed quickly from the hiding place, marvelling once again at how seamlessly the wall panel slid back into place. Unless one knew that it was there, it would be impossible to guess. Miss Radcliffe had been the one to show her the secret chamber. She had caught Ada hiding behind the thick brocade curtains in the library one afternoon when she should have been in a sewing lesson and bade her come to the office where they would have a little talk. Ada had prepared herself for a dressing down, but instead Miss Radcliffe had told her to sit wherever she pleased and said,
"I was not much older than you are now when I first came to this house. My brother and his friends were adults and far too busy with other things to be interested in me. I was given a free run, as they say, and being of a somewhat," she hesitated, "inquisitive disposition, I engaged in rather more exploration than might have been expected."
The house was very old, she continued, hundreds of years old, and had been built at a time in history when certain people had very good reason to seek concealment. She had invited Ada then to follow her, and while all of the other girls were singing Beethoven's Ode to Joy downstairs, Miss Radcliffe had revealed to Ada the secret hideaway.
"I am not sure about you, Miss Lovegrove," she said, "but there have been times in my life when I have felt a very keen need to disappear."
Now Ada hurried along the passage to the central stairwell. Rather than heading downstairs to the music appreciation class, though, she went all the way up to the attic and into the bedroom labelled East Loft that she shared with another boarder, Margaret Worthington. She didn't have much time. Music appreciation class would soon be over and the other girls would be released. Ada knelt on the floor, tossing back the linen valance that was draped around her bed. Her suitcase was still there, exactly where she'd left it, and she slid it out carefully. Ada lifted the lid and the tiny bundle of fur blinked at her, opening his mouth in a silent, emphatic meow. She cupped the kitten in one hand and drew him into a close cuddle.
"There now, little one," she whispered against the soft spot between his ears. "Don't worry, I'm here."
The kitten pawed at her dress with his velvet pads and launched into an indignant tale of hunger and need. Ada smiled and dug inside the deep pocket of the pinafore that Mama had chosen for her at Harrod's, retrieving the jar of sardines she'd pilfered earlier from the kitchen. While her kitten stretched his legs, stalking the room's rim as if it were a wide savanna plain, Ada prized the lid off the jar and withdrew a single slippery fish. Holding it out, she called softly,
"Here, Billy. Here, little cat."
Billy padded towards her, demolishing the dangled sardine, and each one thereafter, until the jar was empty. He then meowed plaintively until Ada set the jar down on its side and let him lick the juice delicately from within.
greedy little fellow,
she said with deepest admiration.
You've gone and got your snout thoroughly wet.
A week ago, Ada saved Billy's life. She had been avoiding Charlotte and May and had found herself on the far side of the meadow beyond the house where the river bend turned around the copse and disappeared from sight. Ada had heard noises coming from the other side of the trees that reminded her of festival time in Bombay and had followed the river westward until she turned a corner and saw a gypsy camp in the clearing beyond. There were caravans and fires, horses and dogs, and children throwing a floating kite with a long tail of colourful ribbons into the air. She had noticed one scruffy boy heading towards the river on his own. He had a sack over his shoulder and was whistling a song that she almost recognised. Curious, Ada had followed him. She crouched behind a tree and watched as he started taking things from the sack one by one and dunking them in the river. She had thought at first that he was cleaning small items of clothing, just as she had seen people doing in Dobie Ghat back home. It was only when she heard the first tiny cry that she realised it wasn't clothing he was drawing from the sack, and that he wasn't cleaning anything.
"Hey, you! What do you think you're doing?"
she had called, pounding over to his side. The boy looked up at her, his shock as clear as the dirt on his face. Ada's voice was quivering.
"I said, what do you think you're doing?"
"Putting them out of their misery, like I've been told to."
"You awful, cruel boy, you beastly coward, you great big thug!"
The boy raised his eyebrows and Ada was galled to realise that he looked amused by the force of her rage. Without a word, he reached into the sack and scooped out the last remaining kitten, holding it aloft by the scruff of its neck with the most indelicate grip.
"Murderer!" she hissed.
"My dad'll murder me if I don't do what he says."
"Give me that little cat at once."
The boy had shrugged and then thrust the limp kitten into Ada's waiting hands before tossing the empty sack over his shoulder and slinking back towards camp. Ada had thought a lot about Billy's brothers and sisters since that day. She woke sometimes in the middle of the night, unable to rid her mind of pictures of their submerged faces and lifeless bodies, tossed and tumbled by the river's current as it carried them out to sea. Now Billy let out a squawk of displeasure as Ada hugged him just a bit too hard. There was a noise outside on the staircase, footfalls, and Ada fumbled the kitten quickly back into the suitcase, dropping the lid but making sure to leave a crack around the rim for air. It was not an ideal solution, but it would do for now. Miss Thornfield, predictably enough, did not tolerate pets. The door opened just as Ada had climbed to her feet. The valance, she'd noticed, was still hooked up near the mattress, but there was no time to fix it. Charlotte Rogers was standing in the doorway. She smiled at Ada, but Ada knew better than to smile back. She remained on guard.
"There you are," said Charlotte sweetly. "Haven't you been a slippery little fish today?"
For a split second, aware of the empty sardine jar in her pocket, Ada thought that Charlotte Rogers had somehow guessed her secret, but the older girl continued.
"I'm just here to deliver a message. The bearer of bad tidings, I'm afraid. Miss Thornfield knows that you skipped music class, and she has asked me to send you to her to receive your punishment."
She smiled with mock sympathy.
"You would get on so much better here if you just learned to follow the rules, Ada. Rule number one is that I always win."
She turned to leave, hesitated, and then looked back.
"Better straighten your bed. I wouldn't like to have to tell Miss Thornfield that you've been slovenly."
Ada's fists were clenched so tightly as she took the stairs down towards Miss Thornfield's office that it was hours before the fingernail marks left her palms. It had become clear that she was not going to win a war of attrition with Charlotte Rogers and May Hawkins simply by ignoring or avoiding them. She would never concede, which meant that she was going to have to strike back, and in such a way that it would get them to leave her alone once and for all. She hardly even heard Miss Thornfield's lecture about tardiness, a
and when the punishment was handed down, a fortnight of extra sewing duties, assisting the costumiers for the end-of-term concert, instead of attending Natural History Society, Ada was too distracted even to mount a protest. She turned over the pieces of the puzzle all afternoon, moving them around, trying to force them to make sense. But it was not until much later that night, while Margaret, her roommate, was snoring softly on the other side of the room, and Billy was purring in her arms, that the idea finally came to her. When it arrived, it was as clear as if someone had entered the room, tiptoed across the floor beside her bed, knelt down low, and whispered the idea into her ear. Ada grinned to herself in the dark. The plan was perfect, and so very simple. Better yet, thanks to Charlotte Rogers, she had been given the perfect means with which to execute it. Chapter 12. The end of summer term concert was an institution at Miss Radcliffe's school for young ladies, and as such, rehearsals had begun in the very first week of term. Miss Byatt, the thin, nervous speech and drama teacher, had held a series of auditions, whittling the show to a select group of 15 performances, comprising musical acts, poetry recitals, and dramatic soliloquies. Ada was to appear in the static, unspeaking role of Mouse 2 as part of a scene from the pantomime of Cinderella. Charlotte Rogers, as the second cousin twice removed of Miss Ellen Terry, was regarded, not least by herself, as a formidable Shakespearean actress, and was thus performing thrice within the show. A recital of one of the sonnets, a rendition of Lady Macbeth's out-damned spot monologue, and a parlour song sung to piano accompaniment provided by her friend May Hawkins. Due to the small size of the two halls within the house, it was customary to stage the concert within the long barn that stood at the top of the coachway. In the days leading up to the show, each girl was responsible for carrying chairs across from the house and arranging them in rows. Those who had not been fortunate enough to be selected for the cast were automatically assigned to stage management tasks, including the assembly of a raised stage and the suspension of proscenium curtains from the rafters above. In light of the punishment handed down by Miss Thornfield, Ada was especially busy, corralled into joining the sewing circle whose members were making final touches to the girls' costumes. The occupation was not a natural fit. Ada was terrible at sewing, certainly not capable of making the rows of strong, neat backstitches necessary to anchor two pieces of fabric together. She had, however, been able to demonstrate that she was adept at trimming loose threads and was thus handed a small pair of silver scissors and tasked with neatening the edges. She is the first one to arrive at each meeting, whereupon she barely makes a peep. Such is her commitment to her work. The sewing mistress reported to Miss Thornfield when asked, to which the deputy headmistress gave a thin smile and said, "Very good to hear." When dawn broke on the day of the concert, the entire school was abuzz. Afternoon lessons were cancelled in order to accommodate a full cast rehearsal, and the show was scheduled to begin promptly at 4. At 2 minutes before the hour, Valerie Miller, who had auditioned unsuccessfully with a rendition of My Wild Irish Rose played on the cowbells, was given a nod by Miss Thornfield and started sounding one of her bells to alert the audience that the show was about to begin. Most of the girls and a smattering of parents and siblings, along with certain very important community members, were already assembled. But the ringing brought their chatter to an end, at which point the lamps within the hall were dimmed and the black curtains dropped, casting the audience into darkness and allowing the limelights lining the stage to take over. One by one, the performers took their places within the glow of centre stage, singing and reciting with all of their might to the warm appreciation of the audience. The programme was not a short one, however, and as the first hour ticked over, the crowd began to flag. By the time Charlotte Rogers appeared on stage for the third time, the younger children were starting to squirm in their seats and yawn, their stomachs to grumble. Charlotte, ever the professional, was undaunted. She planted her feet squarely and blinked prettily at her audience. Her golden hair tumbled in curls, one thick ringlet over each shoulder, and from behind the piano, May Hawkins watched for a signal to start playing, deepest admiration writ large upon her face. Ada's attention, though, was on Charlotte's costume, a rather grown-up blouse and skirt ensemble, modelled, of course, on one of the stage outfits worn recently by Ellen Terry, that made her look older than she was. From her seat in the dark hall, Ada watched the other girl carefully, as if by the power of her gaze alone she might move matter. She was nervous, far more nervous than she had been when she was performing as Mouse Too. Her hands were balled in damp fists upon her lap. It happened as Charlotte hit the highest note, one that she had been practicing to reach for the better part of the month. Perhaps it was the significant intake of breath required to make it to high C, or else the way she thrust her arms out wide to entreat the crowd. Whatever the case, as Charlotte attained her note, she dropped her skirt. The skirt did not drop sluggishly. It dropped suddenly and completely, in one fell swoop, to land in a puddle of white lace and linen on the floor around her dainty ankles. It was 1,000 times better than anything that Ada had dared to imagine. As she trimmed a few of the stitches on Charlotte's waistband, she had hoped that the garment might slip enough to cause agitation and distraction. Never in a million years had she envisaged this. The way the skirt fell, the exceptional timing with which it collapsed completely, almost as if an invisible force controlled by Ada's very mind had swept into the hall and, on receiving a silent command, yanked down the skirt. It was by far and away the funniest thing that Ada had seen in many months, and judging by the thunderous surge of unrestrained laughter that filled the barn, lifting to roll and echo amongst the rafters, the other girls felt the same way. As Charlotte, pink-cheeked, sang the last few lines, and the crowd continued their rapturous hooting applause, Ada realised that for the first time since she had come to Birchwood Manor, she felt almost happy. According to tradition, the supper after the concert was always a more relaxed affair than regular school dinners, and even Miss Thornfield, who generally considered it deeply improper to approach any school event in the spirit of fun, was induced to conduct the annual presentation of the Good Sport Awards. These were a series of amusing accolades, nominated and voted for by the students, with the aim of reinforcing the air of celebration and merriment that infused the school body as the academic year drew to a close. For many of the girls, this would be their last school dinner of term. Only a handful of students, those who did not have homes that could be reached by rail or carriage, or whose parents had travelled to the continent for the summer and been unable to make other arrangements for their daughters, would be staying on through the holidays. Ada was one of them. This fact had brought her spirits lower than they might otherwise have been following the spectacular success of the concert, and she was sitting quietly finishing her second serving of blancmange, turning over the Little Miss Threadgood Award she had been given for services to stitching, printed prior to the costuming disaster one assumed, while the other girls chatted happily about the upcoming summer break, when the daily postal delivery arrived. Ada was so used to being overlooked at mail time that she had to be nudged twice by the girl beside her when her name was called. Up beside the teacher's table, the senior girl on roster was holding a large box. Ada jumped to her feet, eager to claim it, almost tripping over in her hurry. She began untying the twine as soon as she reached her table, slipping out her small silver thread scissors to snip loose the final knots. Inside was a beautiful decoupage box, which Ada identified at once as the perfect new home for Billy. Within the box was a thick envelope promising a letter from Mama, a new sun hat, two dresses, and a smaller package that made Ada's heart leap. She recognised Shashi's handwriting on the gift card at once. Pila, she had written, continuing in Punjabi, a little something to remind you of home while you're living amongst the monkey bottoms. Ada tore open the package to find a small black leather book inside. Between its covers were no words, but instead page after page of pressed flowers, orange hibiscus, mauve queen's crepe myrtle, purple passion flower, white spider lilies, red powder puffs. All of them, Ada knew, had come from her very own garden, and in an instant, she was back in Bombay. She could feel the sultry air on her face, smell the heady fragrance of summer, hear the songs of prayer as the sun set over the ocean. So transported was Ada that she was not aware that Charlotte Rogers had made an approach until the older girl was casting a shadow across Ada's table setting. Ada looked up, taking in Charlotte's serious expression. As usual, May Hawkins was serving as aide-de-camp, and the arrival of the two girls at Ada's table had caused a hush to descend. From instinct, Ada closed Shashi's flower book and slipped it beneath the wrapping paper.
"I suppose you saw what happened during the performance," said Charlotte.
"Terrible," said Ada. "A spot of very bad luck."
Charlotte smiled grimly.
"I've always believed that a person makes her own luck."
There was little for Ada to say in reply. Agreement seemed impolitic.
"I am hoping to have better luck in future."
She held out a hand.
"Truce?"
Ada eyed the outstretched hand before meeting it finally with her own.
"Truce."
They shook solemnly, and when Charlotte gave a small smile, after a moment's consideration, Ada allowed herself to match it. And so, although Ada had not expected to be anticipating the end of summer term picnic with enthusiasm, in light of her recent reconciliation with Charlotte Rogers, she found herself rather looking forward to the day. There were to be games like battledoor and shuttlecock, quoits and skipping, and some of the older girls had even managed to convince Miss Radcliffe to allow them to carry down the small wooden rowing boat that was usually kept stored within the field barn behind the house. The groundsman had looked it over the previous week and, after making a few small repairs, declared the vessel river-worthy. The day when it dawned was warm and clear. An early summer's haze burned off so that by midday the sky was deep blue and the garden glittered. Down by the river, a series of tablecloths were arranged along a stretch of grassy bank that fell beneath two willows, and the teachers were already lounging on them, enjoying the day. Some had brought large white parasols, while others wore sun hats, and a number of woven hampers containing the lunchtime spread were arranged in the shade around the edges of the group. On Miss Radcliffe's instructions, the groundsman had carried a single wooden table over from the house, and it now wore a lace cloth, topped with a vase of delicate pink and yellow roses, jugs of cold lemonade, and a porcelain teapot with assorted glasses, cups and saucers. Shashi had always teased Ada for being a greedy little snout, and it was true. She loved and looked forward to mealtimes. Happily, the picnic did not disappoint. She sat on a square of fabric near Miss Radcliffe, who ate a number of hearty cheese sandwiches whilst pointing out the copse of trees and telling Ada about the first time she had seen Birchwood Manor, when her brother Edward had made them walk from the railway station in Swindon, and they had traipsed all the way through the woods before emerging finally to discover the house like a vision before them. Ada listened intently. She hungered for stories, and Miss Radcliffe was not usually so expansive. Only once before had she spoken in such a way. They had been returning from one of their Natural History Society walks when Birchwood appeared suddenly like a great ship against the dusk-darkening sky. One of the top windows had caught the last of the day's sun glowing orange, and from nowhere a story had unravelled of magical children and a fairy queen. Delighted, Ada had begged her to tell another, but Miss Radcliffe had refused. She'd said that was the only story she knew. A game of blind man's buff was just starting up on the sun-warmed grass beyond the picnic. Indigo Harding was it, and had a white scarf tied over her eyes. A group of six or seven girls were spinning her around, counting each full turn. As they reached the number 10, they all scattered backwards to form a loose circle, and Indigo, dizzy, teetering and laughing, started to reach for them, arms outstretched. Ada had not exactly meant to join in, but she had walked that way, and before she knew it was amongst the group, dodging Indigo's arms and shouting out her own fun taunts. Everybody had a turn at being it, and eventually the scarf was held out to Ada. Her pleasure evaporated, to be replaced at once with apprehension. The game relied on trust, and she hardly knew these girls. There was a river not far away, and she was frightened of water. These fractured thoughts, and others, flitted through her mind in the space of an instant, and then she caught May Hawkins' eyes, and the other girl nodded, in a way that made it seem that she understood. Truce. They had agreed the night before. Now, Ada realized, it was time to put that promise to the test. She stood still while the scarf was tied around her eyes and then allowed the others to spin her, chanting slowly from 1 to 10. Ada's head spun and she could not help laughing to herself as she tried to keep her balance whilst walking towards the others. She waved her hands, listening to their voices. The air felt warm and dense between her fingers. She could hear crickets burring defiantly in the dry grasses, and somewhere behind her a fish leapt from the water, landing with a satisfying plonk. Finally her fingertips brushed someone's face and laughter ensued. Ada pulled the blindfold from her eyes. There was a line of perspiration on her upper lip. Her neck was stiff with tension. Blinking into the sudden brightness, she felt a strange surge of relief-tinged triumph.
"Come on," said May suddenly beside her. "I've thought of something fun to do."
Charlotte was already sitting in the boat when May and Ada reached the river. Her face lit up with a smile when she saw them, and she gestured that they should join her.
"I've been waiting for ages."
"Sorry," called back May. "We were playing blind man's buff."
"Never mind that. Let's go."
Ada stopped where she was and shook her head.
"I can't swim."
"Neither can I," said May, squinting into the sun. "Who said anything about swimming?"
"It's shallow here anyway," said Charlotte. "We're just going to take her upstream a little way and then drift back down. It's such a lovely day."
Ada could see that what Charlotte said was true. Reeds were swaying not too far beneath the surface. The water didn't run deep. Charlotte held up a small paper bag.
"I have boiled sweets."
May grinned and skipped over to where the boat was moored, against a simple wooden jetty, stepping down to sit on the bench in the middle of the boat. Ada looked longingly at the bag of sweets, the two smiling girls, the glittery flecks of sunlight on the river's surface. She heard Shashi telling her not to be frightened, that many people lived half lives due to fear.
"Come on," called May. "We'll lose our turn."
So Ada decided to go with them. She hurried to the end of the jetty and let May help her down onto the bench at the very back.
"What do I do?"
"You don't need to do anything but sit," said Charlotte, untying the rope.
"Let us do the rest."
Ada was glad. Frankly, she was too busy holding on for dear life to do much of anything else. She was keenly aware of the boat's subtle rocking motion as the older girl took the oar and pushed them away from the jetty's end. She gripped the sides tightly, her knuckles white. And then they were floating. And it was almost lovely. She didn't feel seasick at all.
"Of course not," said Charlotte, laughing, when Ada said so. "This is hardly the sea."
The older girl rowed and they travelled slowly upstream. A mother duck trailed by 9 ducklings floated towards them from the other direction. Birds sang in the willows that lined the water. A horse in a field whinnied. The other girls became smaller and smaller specks in the distance. At last, the boat rounded a bend and they were alone. The gypsy camp was only a little further on. Ada wondered whether they were going to go that far upstream. Perhaps they would even go as far as St. John's Lock. But as they were nearing the edge of the copse of trees, Charlotte stopped rowing.
"That's enough of that. My arms are tired."
She held out the paper bag.
"Sweet."
May took a barley sugar and then passed the bag to Ada, who chose a black and white mint humbug.
The river's current was not strong, and rather than begin its drift back downstream, the boat sat happily where it was. Although they were no longer in view of the picnic site, across the fields Ada could see the twin gables at the back of the schoolhouse. She thought of Miss Radcliffe's description of Birchwood Manor as a vision, and realised warmly that some of her teacher's affection for the house was starting to rub off on her.
"It's a shame you got off to such a bad start," said Charlotte, breaking the silence. "All I ever wanted was to help you, Ada. I know how difficult it is to be the new girl."
Ada, sucking on her humbug, nodded.
"But you never listen, and you never seem to learn."
Although Charlotte was still smiling, Ada experienced a sudden, unpleasant jolt of foreboding. At the other end of the boat, the older girl reached to slide something out from beneath her bench seat. It was a decoupage box sent from India. As Ada stiffened, Charlotte removed the lid and reached inside, pulling out the little bundle of fur.
"He is rather sweet, I'll admit, but pets are not allowed at Miss Radcliffe's school, Ada."
Ada stood up at her end of the boat, starting it rocking from side to side.
"Give him to me." "You're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble if you don't let me help you." "Give him to me. What do you think Miss Thornfield will say when I tell her?" "Give him to me."
"I don't think she understands," May Hawkins piped up.
"No," agreed Charlotte. "Such a shame. I'm going to have to teach her."
She slid to the side of her seat and flung her arm out wide so that Billy was almost touching the water. He was the merest scrap in her hand, cycling his hind legs fearfully as he sought to gain purchase, desperately trying to climb to safety.
"I told you, Ada, rule number one, I always win."
Ada took another step and the boat rocked harder. She had to save him. She almost lost her balance, but she didn't sit down. She needed to be brave. May was holding onto her legs now, trying to stop her from getting past.
"Time to say goodbye," said Charlotte.
"No!"
Ada kicked free of May's hold and lunged towards the other girl. The boat was rocking violently now, and Ada fell heavily to the planked wooden floor. Charlotte was still holding Billy out over the water, and Ada scrambled to her feet. She lunged again, and again she fell. This time, though, she didn't hit the planks. The water was so much colder than she had imagined, so much harder. She was gasping for breath, her hands flapping and her mouth opening, her vision blurring wetly. She couldn't stay at the surface. She couldn't cry for help. She began to panic. Down, down, down she went, limbs flailing, mouth filling with water, lungs beginning to burn. Everything was different under here. The world sounded different, and it was getting darker. The sun was a tiny silvery disc beyond the surface, but Ada was falling further away, like a girl in space, surrounded by stars that slipped between her fingers when she reached for them. Through the silty water, amongst the furry reeds, she saw Shashi on the terrace, smiling her wide white smile, and Mama at the desk in the library, and Papa in his study with the spinning globe. Tick, 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 it went when it was spun. Tick, tick, tick. She was going to have a shackley when they reached the market. But where was Shashi? She was gone. Candles flickering. Ada was lost. But she was not alone. There was someone in the water with her. She was sure of it. She couldn't see who it was, but she knew that someone was there. A shadow. A sense. The last thing Ada felt was her body hitting the bottom of the river, her arms and legs impacting against the gentle rocks and slippery weeds as her lungs grew larger than her torso, pushing their way into her throat and filling her head. And then, the strangest thing. As her brain was burning,
She saw something ahead of her. A bright blue shining light. A jewel. A moon. And she knew, somehow, that if she just reached out and grabbed it, the bright blue light would show her the way. 6. Something very interesting has happened. This afternoon we had another visitor. Jack spent the morning in the malt house poring over a stack of papers that he brought in with him when he got home last night. I glanced over them when he went to put a pie in the oven for lunch and gleaned that they replicate the contents of the email sent yesterday by Rosalind Wheeler. For the most part, they are text, but one appears to be a map. A floor plan, more properly, hand-drawn and corresponding largely to the layout of the house, presumably produced by the mysterious Mrs. Wheeler. I suspect that in combination with the written notes, it is designed to lead Jack to the Radcliffe Blue. He came back into the house just before midday, and we passed a contented hour as he tried to make sense of the plan, staring at it and then measuring out footsteps along the lengths of each room, stopping every so often to make a small adjustment with his pen. It was around one when the knock came at the door. He was surprised, but I was not, for I had noticed the slight, elegant woman earlier, standing on the edge of the lane that runs alongside the front wall. She had been staring up at the house, arms folded across her middle, and there was something in her bearing that made me wonder whether I had met her before. I hadn't. I knew that when she came closer. I never forget a face. I never forget anything. Not anymore. People often stand in the laneway and look up at the house. People with dogs and muddy boots, guidebooks and pointed fingers. So there was nothing unusual in that. To venture into the garden and knock on the door, though, is not usual. Jack, despite his initial surprise, took the interruption in his stride, glancing through the kitchen window and then thudding down the hallway towards the door in that heavy, purposeful manner of his, opening it with characteristic might. He has been in a black mood ever since he returned from his meeting with Sarah yesterday. Not angry, rather sad and frustrated. Naturally, I am filled with curiosity as to what went on between them, but thus far he has not obliged me. He made only one call last night, and that was to his father. They were marking an anniversary of some sort, because Jack said, 25 years today. Hard to believe, isn't it? Oh, said the woman, taken aback by the opening door. Hello, I didn't actually... I thought the museum was shut during the week. And yet you knocked? Yes.
Force of habit?
I suppose so. She collected herself and then reached into her bag to retrieve an ivory-coloured piece of card, holding out a small, fine hand to present it to Jack. My name is Elodie Winslow. I'm an archivist with Stratton Cadwell & Co. in London. I look after the archives of James William Stratton. It was my turn then for surprise, and let me assure you, that does not happen often. While Jack's utterance of Ada Lovegrove's name the other night had given me some defence against the return of my past, I was nonetheless momentarily struck. I had not encountered his name in years, and had no reason to think that I would ever hear it again.
Never heard of him, said Jack, turning the card over. Should I have?
Not really. He was a reformer back in Victorian times, improving the plight of the poor, that sort of thing. Are you the person I should speak to about the museum? She sounded doubtful, as well she might. There is little of Jack that gives any impression of the guides who usually man the door, foisting their rehearsed patter upon visitors no matter how many times they have spouted it before.
In a manner of speaking, I'm the only person here.
She looked unconvinced, but said, I know you're not usually open on Fridays, but I've come from London. I didn't expect to find anyone here. I was just going to peek over the wall, but...
You want to look around the house?
If you wouldn't mind. Invite her in.
After a moment's consideration, Jack stepped aside and gestured in that generous, physical way of his, indicating that she should come inside. He closed the door quickly behind her. She stepped into the dim hall and glanced about her, as most people do, leaning close to view one of the framed photographs that the Art Historians Association has hung along the walls. Some days, when I am in need of amusement, I haunt the entrance hallway, enjoying the reverent comments made by visitors of a certain type while they postulate as to the events behind the photo.
"It was at this time, of course,"
the sensibly outfitted man of advanced years will intone,
"that the Magenta Brotherhood were engaged in fierce debate with respect to the artistic worth of photography, wondering whether it might in fact be more properly considered a science than an art."
To which the long-suffering companion beside him will invariably reply,
"Oh, I see."
"Make yourself at home," said Jack, in a careful sort of way. She smiled. "Don't worry, I'm an archivist. I spend my life taking care of precious things." "You'll have to excuse me a minute. I have a pie in the oven and I can smell it burning." He was already backing away towards the Malthouse kitchen, and I left him uttering his expletives to follow our visitor. She walked from room to room downstairs, an enigmatic expression on her face. Only once did she stop and stifle a small shiver, glancing over her shoulder as if she sensed that she might not be alone. On the first floor, she hesitated at the window overlooking the woods to glimpse the river, before climbing the stairs all the way to the attic. She set her bag down on Mildred Manning's table, which disposed me at once to like her, and then took something from within that made me startle. It was one of Edward's sketchbooks. I would have known it anywhere. The shock was almost physical. More than anything, I wanted to grab her by the wrists and implore her to tell me everything. Who she is and how she came by Edward's book. She had mentioned James William Stratton, a company called Stratton Cadwell & Co., and a collection of archives. Is that where the sketchbooks have been stored all of this time? But how on earth could that be? The two men did not know each other. As far as I'm aware, they never even met. After turning through the pages of the sketchbook quickly, as if she had done so many times before and knew precisely what she was searching for, she stopped at an illustration and studied it closely. She then went to the window overlooking the back meadow and stood on tiptoe, craning her neck to see. The sketchbook was still open on the table and I rushed to it. It was the one that Edward used over the summer of 1862. I had sat beside him while he made those very lines on that piece of cotton paper, studies for the painting he had planned, something he had been thinking about for years. On the following pages, I knew, were his sketches of the clearing in the woods and the fairy mound and a stone croft by the river, and at the bottom corner of one, in loose, scratched lines, the heart he had penned and the ship on the wide sea as we spoke excitedly of our plans. I wanted nothing more than to be able to turn those pages, to see the other drawings, to touch the memory of those days. But alas, after much experimentation over the years, I have had to accept that my abilities in that respect are limited. I can make a door slam or a window rattle. I can yank the loosened skirt of a nasty schoolgirl. But when it comes to finer manipulations, the pulling of a thread or the turning of a page, I do not have the necessary control. I need to know what brought her to the house today. Is she simply an art lover, or is there more to it than that? It is remarkable enough that after so many years, I should have at once a visitor mention the name Ada Lovegrove and now another speak of James Stratton. But for the latter then to produce Edward's sketchbook from the summer of 1862 is uncanny. I cannot help but think there is unseen mischief at work. My young man Jack was curious too, in his own way, for when she went back downstairs and ducked her head around the door into the Malthouse kitchen to call out, "Thank you!" he looked up over the top of the blackened dish that he was scraping into the sink and said,
"Found what you were looking for?"
There came then the most infuriating of non-answers.
"You've been very kind," she said. "Thanks so much for letting me in on a Friday."
Not so much as a hint as to her purpose.
"Are you staying nearby?"
he asked, as she started down the hallway towards the front door.
"Or heading back to London now?"
"I have a room booked at the Swan, the pub down the road, just for the weekend."
I shifted closer and concentrated all of my might on sending him my message.
"Invite her to stay. Invite her to come back."
"Feel free to drop in any time," he said, a look of brief confusion settling on his face. "I'm here every day."
"I might just do that."
It was, as they say, when they must because they've been denied their heart's desire, better than a kick in the teeth. Her visit was brief, but the disturbance sat in the house all afternoon. It left me flummoxed and excited, and so while Jack got on with his inspection of the house, he is in the hallway on the first floor now, running his hand lightly along the wall, I retreated to my spot at the bend of the stairs, from which I distracted myself by ruminating on the old days. Mostly, I thought of Pale Joe and the morning that we met. For while I was a good thief, I was not above making mistakes. Ordinarily, they were inconsequential and easily resolved. I chose to target the wrong person. I was forced to give a policeman the slip. I picked a wallet only to find it as empty as a fool's promise. On one occasion, though, when I was 12 years old, I made a mistake with more far-reaching consequences. It was one of those London mornings when the sun does not rise so much as the fog changes colour from black to pewter to a yellow-tinged gunmetal grey. The air was thick with factory smog and the oily smell rising from the river. It had been thus for days, and I had suffered a poor week's takings. There were simply fewer fine ladies willing to ride alone in London when the sullen fogs came in. That morning I had taken little girl passenger on the omnibus that ran between the Regent's Park and Holborn, in the hope that I might find the wife or daughter of a lawyer returning from her morning stroll around the park. The plan was sound, but my technique was not, for I was distracted by a conversation I'd had with Mrs. Mack the night before. Although she was of an optimistic disposition, Mrs. Mack had an image to uphold and was thus never happier than when she had a gripe in her mouth. One of her frequent laments, owing to the expense of keeping me in fine dresses, was that I grew like a weed. "No sooner do I finish letting out the seams or dropping the hems, then I have to go back and start all over again." This time, however, she had not left the comment there. "The captain and I have been saying it might be time we made some changes to your work. You're getting too old to be little girl lost. Won't be long, and those helpful gentlemen are gonna be getting other ideas about how they might like to help a pretty girl like you. More so, how you might be able to help them." I didn't want to make changes to my work, and I was quite sure that I didn't like Mrs. Mack's insinuation as to the sort of help I might be able to render the gentleman. I had started to perceive a change in the way the barflies at the Anchor and Whistle looked at me when I was sent in to drag the captain home for dinner, and I knew enough to realise that it had more than a bit to do with the "nice little pair of buds" that Mrs. Mack had noted when she was measuring me up for recent alterations. Martin, too, had begun to observe me more closely. He lingered in the hallway outside the room where I slept, and when I dressed in the mornings, where light should spill through the keyhole, it was dark instead. I was finding it almost impossible to escape his watch. It had always been a part of his role within his mother's enterprise to keep an overseeing eye on things, to make sure that none of us kids mistakenly dragged home trouble in the evenings. But this was different. And so as I rode the omnibus that morning, as I slipped my hand into the pocket of the lady beside me and felt her purse beneath my fingertips, I was not concentrating as I should have been. I was turning over Mrs. Mack's worrying pronouncement, probing it for implications and wondering for the umpteenth time why my father still had not sent for me. Every month or so, Jeremiah would arrive to collect from Mrs. Mack the money to be forwarded on to America. And Mrs. Mack would read me my father's most recent letter. But whenever I asked whether he had instructed me to purchase a ticket to America, she told me no, that it was not yet time. Thus I was careless, and the first I knew that the lady was intending to leave the omnibus was when I felt the tug against my hand as she stood up, taking her pocket with her and my arm with it. And then the cry of,
"Why, you little thief!"
Over the years, I had prepared myself for this precise scenario. I had been through it many times in my head. I should have feigned innocence, widened my eyes, and pretended that it was all a mistake, perhaps even produced some pitiable tears. But I was caught unawares. I hesitated a fraction too long. All that I could hear was Mrs. Mack's voice reminding me that accusing is proving where power sits in judgment. Against this lady with her fancy hat, fine manners, and wounded delicacy, I was nothing. The driver was moving up the aisle towards me. A gentleman two seats ahead was on his feet. I glanced over my shoulder and saw that there was a relatively clear path towards the rear door, and so I ran. I was a good runner, but in a stroke of bad luck, a newly minted policeman doing rounds nearby heard the commotion, saw me take flight, and with a jolt of lusty enthusiasm, began to give chase.
"Stop, thief!"
he yelled, wielding his baton above his head. It was not the first time that I had been pursued by a policeman, but on this particular morning the fog had driven me too far north to be able to rely on any of my friends to help my flight. As Lily Millington had warned, to risk capture at my age was to flirt with a one-way ticket to the workhouse, so I had no choice but to run as hard as I could towards the safety of Covent Garden. My heart pounded as I pelted down Red Lion Square. The policeman was carrying more weight than he might, but he was nonetheless a grown man and faster than I was. High Holborn was teeming with traffic and my spirits lifted. I could duck and weave between vehicles and that way escape him. But alas, when I reached the other side and shot a look over my shoulder, he was still there, even closer than before. I slipped down a narrow alleyway and immediately realized my folly. On the other side was Lincoln's Inn Fields, with its wide green plain offering nowhere to hide. I was out of options. He was almost upon me. And then I glimpsed a slender lane that ran behind the imposing row of rendered houses, a ladder snaking up the brick back of the nearest one. With a surge of elation, I gambled that I would be faster than the policeman if I were to move the chase off the ground. I began to climb step by step as quickly as I could. The ladder shook beneath my grip as my pursuer clambered after me, his heavy boots clanging on the metal rungs. Higher and higher I went, past one, two, three rows of windows, and when I had gone as high as the ladder would take me, I scrambled off and onto the slate tiles of the rooftop. I picked my way along the guttering, arms out wide to keep my balance, and when one house gave way to the next, I climbed over the partitions between them and shimmied past the chimneys. I had been correct in my assumption that I would have an advantage at height, for although he was still behind me, I had gained a small amount of breathing space. But my relief was short-lived. I was already well along the row of houses, and once I reached the other side, there was nowhere further for me to go. Just as the dire realization was dawning, I saw it. One of the windows in a rooftop dormer was pushed halfway open in its sash. I didn't think twice. I forced it higher still and slipped beneath. I fell hard to the floor, but there was not a spare second to admit injury. I scurried to fit under the wide sill, pressing myself against the wall in a tight crouch. My pulse was roaring such that I was sure the policeman would be able to hear it. I needed to silence it so that I could hear him pass, for only then would I know that it was safe to climb out again and start making my way home. It had been such a blessed relief to find the window open that I hadn't given a single moment's thought as to what sort of room I was leaping into. Now, though, as I began to catch my breath, I turned my head to take stock and saw that I was in the bedroom of a child, which was not a disaster in itself, except that the child in question was in current occupation of the bed, and looking directly at me. He was the palest creature I had ever seen. About my age, with a wan face and hair the colour of bleached straw, propped up against enormous white feather pillows, his waxen arms draped limply over the smooth linen sheets. I tried to smile reassuringly and had opened my mouth to speak when I realised that there was nothing I could say or do to make the moment seem normal. What was more, the policeman would be upon us at any minute, and really, it would be best if neither of us were to say anything. I lifted my finger to my lips to implore the boy to silence, aware that he held my fate in his hands, and then he spoke.
"If you come any nearer..."
His vowels were so crystal sharp that they sliced through the room's thick, stale air.
"I shall call for my father, and you will be on a transport ship to Australia before you can utter even the hint of an apology."
Transportation was about the only thing worse than the workhouse, and I was trying to find the words to explain to him how it came to pass that I had arrived in his room through a rooftop window when I heard another voice, the gruff, embarrassed tones of a man above me at the window saying,
"My apologies, sir, little master. There was a girl I was chasing, you see, a young girl running away from me."
"A young girl on the rooftop? Have you gone mad?"
Not at all, little master. She climbed, you see, like a monkey, straight up the ladder."
"You expect me to believe that a young girl outran you?"
"Well, yes, sir."
"And you a grown man?"
A slight pause.
"Yes, sir."
"Remove yourself from my bedroom window this minute, or I shall call out at the top of my lungs. Do you know who my father is?"
"Yes, sir, but you see, sir, there was a girl..."
"This minute."
"Sir? Yes, sir. Very good, sir."
There was a scuffling noise on the roof, followed by the sound of something heavy sliding along tiles, and then a diminishing yelp. The boy turned his attention to me. It was my experience that when there was nothing to be said, it was best to say nothing, and so I waited to see which way the wind was going to blow. He regarded me quizzically, before saying finally,
"Hello."
"Hello." With the policeman gone, there seemed little point in remaining crouched, and so I stood. It was my first opportunity to look properly at the room, and I am not ashamed to say that I was powerless to stop gawping. I had never seen anything like it. The room was a nursery with a slanted roofline and shelves lining the walls from floor to ceiling, upon which sat an example of every toy I could have thought to name. Wooden soldiers and skittles, balls and bats and marbles, a remarkable clockwork train engine with carriages containing little dolls, an ark with pairs of each animal under the sun, a set of spinning tops in different sizes, a red and white drum, a jack-in-the-box, and a rocking horse in the corner, keeping a cool eye on things. A Punch and Judy set, an elaborate doll's house that stood as tall as I did on its plinth, a spinning hoop and stick that had the shining look of items that had never before been used. As I conducted my inspection, my eyes alit upon a tray on the foot of his bed. It was covered with the sort of food I had glimpsed through the windows in Mayfair, but never even hoped to sample for myself. My stomach became a knot, and perhaps he noticed me staring because he said,
"You would be doing me a great favour were you to eat some. They are always trying to feed me, even though I've told them I'm rarely hungry."
I did not need to be told twice. The food on the tray was still warm, and I ate it gratefully. Perched on the very end of his quilted bed, I was too busy eating to speak, and as he was inclined to do neither, we watched one another warily across the tray. When I was finished, I patted my mouth with a napkin, the way Mrs. Mack always did, and smiled cautiously.
"Why are you in bed?"
"I am not well."
"What's the matter with you?"
"There seems to be a degree of uncertainty in that regard."
"Are you going to die?"
He considered.
"It is possible, although I haven't to this point, which I take as a positive sign."
I nodded in agreement, but also encouragement. I did not know this strange pale boy, but I was glad to think that he was not at death's door.
"But how rude of me," he said. "Forgive me, I don't have many guests."
He held out a fine hand.
"I was named for my father, of course, but you shall call me just plain Joe. And you are?"
As I took his hand, I thought of Lily Millington. Inventing a name was by far and away the more sensible thing to do, and I still cannot say why I told him the truth. An irrepressible urge started deep down inside my stomach, and then rose, growing in pace and solidity, until I could resist it no longer.
"I was named for my mother's father," I said, "but my friends call me Birdie."
"And so shall I, for you arrived on my windowsill just like a bird."
"Thank you for lending it to me."
"Not at all. I've often had cause, lying here with nothing much else to look at, to wonder why the builders wasted so much material on making it so wide. I see now that they were wiser than I gave them credit."
He smiled at me, and I smiled back. On the table beside him was something that I had never seen before. I felt emboldened by his kindness and picked it up. It was a disc with pieces of twine attached to two opposing edges. On one side was drawn a canary, and on the other side a metal cage.
"What is this?"
He indicated that I should hand it to him.
"It's called a thaumatrope."
He held one of the strings and then rotated the disc so that it wound tightly. Holding both strings, he then pulled them away from one another so that the disc began to spin rapidly. I clapped, delighted, as the bird suddenly flew into the cage.
"Magic," he said.
"An illusion," I corrected.
"Yes, quite right. It is a trick, but a pretty one."
With a final glance at the thaumatrope, I thanked him for the lunch and told him that I had to go.
"No," he said quickly, shaking his head. "I forbid it."
The response was so unexpected that I could think of nothing to say. It was all I could do not to burst out laughing that this pale, bedridden boy thought he might be capable of forbidding me anything. It made me sad, too, because in three words, he had exposed himself so plainly, both his wishes and his limitations. Perhaps he also glimpsed the absurdity of his order, for his tone lost its bravado, and he continued almost desperately.
"Please, you must stay longer.
I will be in trouble if I stay out after dark."
"There's plenty of time until sunset, 2 hours at least."
"But I haven't done my work. I've nothing to show for the day."
Pale Joe was confused by this and asked what sort of work I meant. Did I mean schoolwork? And if so, where were my books and slate, and where did I intend to meet my governess? I told him that I did not mean schoolwork, that I had never been to school, and I explained to him about my omnibus route and the gloves and the dresses with the deep pockets. He listened to this account with widening eyes and then asked me to show him the gloves. I sat closer to him on the edge of the bed, pulled them from my pocket and arranged them on my lap, acting the part of the little lady in her carriage.
"You see that my hands are here," I said, nodding at the gloves, to which he agreed.
"And yet," I continued,
"what is this?"
He gasped, because without appearing to alter my position, I had slipped my actual hand beneath the covers to tickle his knee.
"And that is how it works,"
I said, jumping off the bed and smoothing my skirts.
"But that is wonderful,"
he said, a quick smile spreading across his face, restoring to him, briefly, a welcome look of life.
"And you do this every day?"
I was at the window now, surveying the climb back down. "Mostly. Sometimes I just pretend to be lost and then pick the pocket of the gentleman who helps me."
"And the things you take, purses, jewellery, you deliver them home to your mother?"
"My mother is dead."
"An orphan," he said reverently. "I have read books about them."
"No, not an orphan. My father is away for a time, but he's going to send for me as soon as he's settled." I hoisted myself onto the sill.
"Don't go," said the boy. "Not yet."
"I have to."
"Then come again, please. Say you will."
I hesitated. To agree, I knew, would be foolish.
This was not an area that a young girl without a chaperone would go unnoticed for long, and the policeman at the end of the street knew me now.
He might not have had a chance to see my face, but he had already given chase, and the next time I might not be so lucky. But then that food, I'd never tasted anything like it, and those shelves of toys and wonders.
"Take this," said Pale Joe, holding the thaumatrope towards me. "It's yours, and next time you come, I promise I'll show you something far, far better."
And that is how I came to meet Pale Joe, and he became my secret, just as surely as I became his. There has been a shift in the house's temperament. Something of importance has happened while I was thinking of my old friend Pale Joe. Sure enough, Jack is in the hallway, a look upon his face just like the cat that got the cream. It does not take me long to realize why. He is standing in front of the hiding hole, its concealed panel wide open. He has gone off now at a trot back to his room in order to fetch his torch, I imagine. Despite telling Rosalind Wheeler that he would not enter the house before Saturday, I understand curiosity and its demands and have no doubt that he has plans to search every square inch of the hiding hole, every groove within the boards, in the hope that he might find the diamond lurking. He won't. It isn't there. But all truths must not be told at all times. It will do him no harm to search. I rather like him when frustration makes him bearish. I am going to leave him to it and wait for him in the malt house. I have other things to think about, like Ella D. Winslow's visit. There was something familiar in her bearing when she was here this afternoon. I couldn't place it at first, but I have since realized what it was. When she entered the house, as she walked about its rooms, she let out a sigh that no one else but I would have been able to detect, and I saw upon her face a look of satisfaction that could almost be termed completeness. It reminded me of Edward. It is the same way that he looked when we first came to this house. But Edward had a reason to feel such strong attachment. He was tethered to this place when just a boy by his night of terror in the nearby fields. Why is Ella D. Winslow here? What is her connection to Birchwood Manor? I hope that she comes back. I wish it with a fervency that I have not felt in years. I begin to understand at last how it must have been for Pale Joe that first day, when he promised to show me something wonderful if I would only agree to return. One becomes rather desperate for visitors when one has lost the power to visit. After Edward, Pale Joe is the person whom I missed most in this limbo of mine. I used to think of him a lot and wonder what became of him, for he was a special person. He had been poorly for some time when I met him, and his life of isolation in that room of untouched treasures made him far more interested than most in the world beyond his window. Everything that Pale Joe knew, he had learned from books, and thus there was a lot he did not understand about the way things worked. He could not comprehend when I told him about the pokey damp rooms that I had shared with my father in the shadow of St. Anne's, the communal privy and the toothless old woman who cleaned it out in exchange for leftover cinders. What happened to Lily Millington, perhaps saddest of all? He wanted to know why people would choose to live in such a way, and was forever asking me to tell him stories of the London that I knew, the alleyways of Covent Garden, the dark areas of commerce below the bridges along the Thames, the infants with no parents. He wanted to hear especially about the babies who had come to live with Mrs. Mack, and his eyes would fill with tears when I told him of those unlucky little ones who just weren't strong enough for this world. I wonder what he thought when I disappeared so completely from his life. Did he look for me? Not at first, but eventually, when more time passed than could be explained away with logic. Did he doubt and ask questions, or did he believe the worst? Pale Joe was the same age that I was, born in 1844. If he lived into old age, he would have been 87 years old when Leonard's book was published. Being such an avid reader, we read together often up there in his attic bedroom, the two of us sitting shoulder to shoulder in his white linen nest. He was always aware of what was being published and when. He was a lover of art, too, a passion acquired from his father, whose house on Lincoln's Inn Fields was filled with Turners.
Yes, I feel sure that Pale Joe would have read Leonard's book. What did he make of its theories, I wonder? Did he believe me a faithless jewel thief who fled to a better life in America? Pale Joe certainly knew me capable of thievery. He knew me better than Edward in some respects. We had met, after all, when I was mid-flight from a policeman, and from the start he had been filled with questions about Mrs. Mack and her enterprise, delighting in my tales of little girl lost and little girl passenger, and as time went on, theatre-going lady, encouraging me to tell him my stories, as if they described great feats of derring-do. Pale Joe knew, too, that I had resolved that if my father did not send for me, I would travel to America and find him. For although Jeremiah delivered regular reports, standing importantly in Mrs. Mack's parlour as she read out letters in which my father described his efforts to remake himself and encouraged me to listen to Mrs. Mack and do as she bade me, I was always concerned that there was something I was not being told. For if my father's new life was progressing as his letters said, then why did he continue to insist that I should not yet join him? But later, Pale Joe knew that I also loved Edward. Indeed, it was he who saw it first. I can still remember the night on the evening of the Royal Academy Exhibition of 1861, when Edward invited me to see the La Belle painting unveiled, and afterwards I went to Pale Joe's window. I have had much time since to reflect upon Pale Joe's words that evening, after I gave him my report. "You are in love," he said. "For that is exactly how love feels. It is the lifting of a mask, the revealing of one's true self to another, and the forced acceptance, the awful awareness, that the other person may never feel the same way." He was wise about love, Pale Joe, for a boy who rarely left his bower. His mother was always encouraging him to attend society dances so that he could meet London's eligible young debutantes, and many times, as I bade him farewell, I left him to dress in his black and white suit for this dinner or that. I used to think about him as I hurried back along the laneways towards Covent Garden, my pale, elegant friend with his limp and his kind heart, who had grown tall in the 5 years since we'd met, and handsome. And I pictured the two of us as if from above, going about our parallel lives in the one great city. I suppose Pale Joe must have met a woman at one of those dances, a fine lady with whom he fell in love as completely as I did with Edward, and who perhaps did not reciprocate because his words that night were perfect. He never did have the chance to tell me who she was. The last time that I saw Pale Joe, we were 18 years old. I had come to his window to let him know that I'd agreed to go with Edward to Birchwood Manor for the summer. I revealed nothing of my plans beyond. I didn't even say a proper farewell. I didn't think I had to. Not then. I thought that there would be more time. I suppose people always do. Jack is back in the malt house, and my house is calm again, catching its breath after a day of unusual activity. It has been a long time since anyone ventured inside the hiding hole. He is dispirited, but not because he failed to find the stone. Its absence will involve another telephone call to Rosalind Wheeler, which will not be pleasant, for she will not be happy. But the search for the Radcliffe Blue is just a job for Jack. He has no personal connection other than human curiosity driving his quest. His mood is related, I am certain, to his meeting yesterday with Sarah regarding the two little girls. I long to know what happened between them. It gives me something to focus on besides my own memories and the endless, aimless stretch of time. He has put aside Mrs. Wheeler's notes and floor plan and picked up his camera. I have noticed a pattern with Jack. When something upsets him, he takes out his camera and looks through the lens, pointing it at things. Anything, it seems, fiddling with the aperture and the focus, and bringing the zoom in close before retracting it again. Sometimes he takes the shot. More often than not, he doesn't. By and by, his equilibrium is restored, and the camera goes away. Today, however, he is not so easily mended. He returns the camera to its bag and then hangs the strap over his shoulder. He intends to go outside to take more photographs. I am going to wait for him in my favourite corner at the turn of the stairs. I like to look at the Thames between the trees beyond the meadow. The river is quiet up here, Only the canal boats go back and forth, dragging after them the faint plume of coal smoke. One can hear the plink of a fishing line being sunk, the skid of a duck coming into land on the surface, laughter sometimes in the summer if the day is warm enough to swim. What I said earlier was not entirely truthful, that I have never managed to go as far as the river. There was one time, and one time only. I did not mention it because I still cannot explain it. But on the afternoon that Ada Lovegrove fell from the boat, I was there, in the river, watching as she sank to the bottom. Edward used to say that the river possessed a primeval memory of everything that had ever happened. It occurs to me that this house is like that too. It remembers, just as I do. It remembers everything. Such thoughts bring me back to Leonard. He had been a soldier but was a student by the time he arrived at Birchwood Manor, working on a dissertation about Edward, his papers spread across the desk in the Mulberry Room downstairs. It was from him that I learned much of what happened after Fanny died. Amongst his research notes were letters and newspaper articles, and eventually the police reports too. What a strange feeling it was to read the name, Lily Millington, there amongst the others. Thurston Holmes, Felix and Adele Bernard, Francis Brown, Edward, Claire and Lucy Radcliffe. I saw the policemen as they carried out their investigation into Fanny's death. I watched as they searched the rooms, raking through Adele's clothing and stripping the walls of Felix's dark room. I was there when the shorter of the two men pocketed a photograph of Claire in her lace slip, tucking it inside his straining coat. I was there too when they cleared out Edward's studio, taking from it everything they could find that might shed light on me. Leonard had a dog that would sleep on the armchair as he worked, a great big shaggy animal with muddy paws and a long-suffering expression. I like animals. They are often aware of me when people are not. They make me feel appreciated. It is amazing how far a little acknowledgement will go when one has become used to being ignored. He brought a record player with him and used to play songs late at night, and he kept a glass pipe on the table beside his bed, an object I recognised from the time of my father's nights in the Chinese den in the Limehouse. Occasionally, a woman, Kitty, came to visit, and he would hide the pipe away. I watched him sometimes when he slept, just as I watch Jack now. He had military habits, like the old major who was known to Mrs. Mack and the captain, who could beat a young girl where she stood but wouldn't countenance falling into bed without polishing his boots and lining them up carefully for the next day. Leonard wasn't violent, but his nightmares were bleak. Neat as a pin, quiet and polite by day, but with dreams of the darkest kind. He would shake in his sleep and wince, and call out in a voice made raw with fear. Tom, he used to call. Tommy. I used to wonder about Tommy. Leonard cried for him as one might for a lost child. On the nights when he smoked through the glass pipe and fell into a languorous sleep where Tommy couldn't find him, I sat in the still of the dark house and thought of my father, of how long I waited for him to come back for me. And when Leonard didn't use the pipe, I stayed with him. I understand despair. And so on those nights, I knelt and whispered in that young man's ear, "It is all right. Be at peace. Tommy says that he is well." Tom. Tommy. I still hear his name on nights when the wind blows strong down the river and the floorboards quiver. Chapter 13. Summer 1928. It was the hottest day so far, and Leonard had determined when he woke that he would swim. He'd taken to strolling along the towpath in the early mornings, and sometimes again in the hovering afternoons that burned on and on before fading suddenly like a limelight being snuffed. The Thames here had a vastly different character to the wide, muddy tyrant that seethed through London. It was graceful and deft and remarkably light of heart. It skipped over stones and skimmed its banks, water so clear that one could see the reeds swaying deep down on her narrow bed. The river here was a she, he'd decided. For all its sunlit transparency, there were certain spots in which it was suddenly unfathomable. A long dry stretch through June had given him ample opportunity to explore, and Leonard had discovered a particularly inviting bend a mile or two upstream before the lech-laid Halfpenny Bridge. A co-op of scrappy children had set up camp for the summer in a field just beyond, but a coppice of birch trees gave the bend its privacy. He was sitting now with his back against the trunk of a willow, wishing he'd finished the repairs he was planning to make to the old wooden rowing boat he'd found in the barn behind the house. The day was perfectly still,